This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. If you happen to visit the campus of the University of North Carolina at Greensboro in 2016, you may have seen a man in an orange jumpsuit. That was visual artist Cheryl Rowland. Cheryl is the visionary behind the Jumpsuit Project, a performance arts piece that raises awareness about mass incarceration. Cheryl launched the project after spending more than 10 months in prison for a crime he didn't commit. But long before his incarceration, he was a kid growing up in Asheville, learning to draw from comic books and magazines. And Cheryl Rowland joins us right now. Welcome back to the State of Things, Cheryl.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back.
It's good to have you here. You know, your passion for art has been a continuous thread in your life, and I suppose some might link that to your upbringing in Asheville, associated with the arts as it is now, but it was a very different city back when you were a young man growing up in that city. Is that right?
Yes, indeed. Asheville has definitely taken on a life of its own and has kind of grown up, you know, as I've been away.
Well, let's talk about your experience there and what piqued your interest in art.
Well, I think it was a lot of things on the peripheral. I think for me growing up, I got into a lot of sports, but mainly just, was kind of a quiet kid, always liked to draw and things of that nature. So there was a lot of things that are around me that as I grew up, I understood played kind of like a little small influence in my life, like trips with my mom down to Cherokee. Paintings and other small objects that she used to buy me when we took those trips. But then also my best friend's older brother, he used to trace and draw himself. And I think that's what really started to pique my interest when I started to see things in my close proximity that kind of opened up my imagination.
What were the subjects that you found yourself most attracted to?
I think things that, were just now like opening up to me. My older sister, she introduced me to by buying my first rap album and things of that nature. So I inherited a lot of things from her coming up, especially my shoe addiction. But as those things trickled down to me at a young age, it kind of continued to feed my curiosity for these things as I grew up. And then through that, I guess it's an early process now that I'm recognizing now that what was being fed to my imagination, I end up pushing back out with pencil and paper.
Yeah, I mean, it's like superheroes and rap artists, right? And I mean,
Yeah. Those things were, those things were cool, new, interesting to me, all around me. I started going to school there around. I remember Snoop Dogg's album in 1996, Doggy Style, was a comic book booklet that came with the cassette tape. And so it was when those worlds started to merge, I guess for me it was the right time. It was oh, wow, it's coming out in the music. It's coming everywhere. It's presenting itself to me in all these different facets of my life.
I mean, it's interesting. I want to take you back to kind of what's going on inside your head, because obviously pop culture is very attractive. You also were doing superheroes, right? Spider-Man, that sort of thing. And every kid's mm-hmm. attracted to that kind of thing. It's the music that's in the air. It's the music everybody's listening to. The art attracts mm-hmm. you. But at some point, you wanted to recreate it. And I wonder kind of how that's different for you than just consuming the culture, and kind of how it was different from you, even in tracing those figures like Spider-Man or Snoop.
I guess I don't want to speak for everybody else, but I think it was a way of also formulating myself in these things that I thought was cool. Eventually it was duplicating. And once I became able to duplicate these things by learning how to trace and whatnot, then I started manipulating, right? Then I started drawing my face on mm-hmm. Spider-Man and my face in the cool Averex jacket or, Timberland boots or whatever was in style on these magazines. So it was just kind of also illustrating myself in these positions that I thought were cool.
And your family encouraged your interest in art growing up, right? Several family members came from professions where they worked with their hands. So how did that influence you?
Yeah, I think, there's support all around, especially on my father's side. There was a lot of beauticians and barbers and also musicians. I've had, cousins and family members who started their own record label, still, you know, dive in creativity, like through music, creating, like, you know, producing records and things of that nature. So it's always been around. And then it also gave me an opportunity to do my thing. So, like, I might draw a logo, or I might, you know, draw a cover or do these things. So I always had a place next to these other creatives, which really helped. And then the support at a young age was just really nice. Like, you know, I remember one night I was at my granny's house with a cousin of mine, and I drew a Charlotte Hornet, their logo at the time. And my cousin saw it. He grabbed it, ran into our granny's room and was like, you know, look what he drew, look what he drew. And then, like, those, that type of encouragement and support kind of, like, was the, you know, things that kept me going.
Well, talk about the relationship, too, with other family members, because I know your dad passed when you were very young. So you mm-hmm. and your sister were raised by your mom. What kind of relationship did you have, well, with your mom at that time?
Well, I mean, I guess it was just me being young. My mom had to kind of be everything for me. And, you know, so she was like, you know, my dad, my mom, you know, my mom taught me how to cut grass. Like, you know, so these, you know, my mom had to embody all of these things. And so it was really good, but my sister was cool. She was close to me. She had nice taste in food and everything like that. So as we would complain about the mundane stuff that my mom would cook, just by, you know, being, you know, my mom worked a lot. She didn't have time to do all these extravagant meals. By the time my sister was able to cook, we were eating, like, totally different things. And so I guess I gravitated towards that newness, that passion, that things that, like, you know, that were more imaginative. I think my mom had a level of discipline that she had to kind of display just by the position that she held in our household.
As you look back, what else have you learned about? Because it's so easy to overlook what's happening at the time and find even some of it to be a little bit annoying or nagging. But as you look back now and see how your mom supported you during your childhood as you got older, how do you view that now?
Oh, man, that was one of the things, like, you know, again, to reiterate that discipline. Like, you know, when I was young, I didn't want any rules. I wanted everything to be my way. And then once I got older and kind of hit my own trials and tribulations through college, returning back home, having those responsibilities be placed on me, understanding, like, you know, it just reposition myself when considering excuses or saying that I can't do something. And that came from, like, you know, what was instilled way before I noticed it in my mom. Like, my mom never made any excuses. She just kept pushing and kept pushing to get what she want. And mostly that was just for me and my sister to be able to do what we wanted. And so, like, when I came back home from when I was in undergrad, I had recognized, you know, what my mother was showing me by doing. And it taught me a lot, and it, you know, it allowed me to mature in ways.
Well, one of the things that changes as we grow older is our relationship and understanding of what our parents did for us. Another thing that changed in your case, as we made reference to earlier, is Asheville. That is certainly a place that had once had your granny's storefront, right? Your cousin's barbershop on Eagle Street. And now you visit your childhood home. How much has changed?
So much. Every time I come back, even, you know, that's within a span of 6 months or whatever, there's a new store. There's somebody from out of town that has relocated and came to Asheville, which it's the appeal. You know, Asheville has always been, you know, I don't know, top 10 places to come visit. So it's always been an attraction. But now the population has changed, right? Like, you know, with more people coming, the traffic is slower. They're adding new stop signs. So every time I come, it's like these little nuances of the city that have completely changed and threw off the things that I was comfortable with of growing up, the secrets that I knew, the back roads that I knew to take to get around certain traffic now has just been completely changed. And as well as neighborhoods and communities that I used to, like, that my family members used to live in, and I used to go spend a night at their house on the weekends. Like, some of those places don't even exist anymore and have been converted to kind of appeal to the new population right. That are coming in.
Well, one of the things, I guess, that makes it maybe more difficult for you when you go home is now you have to dodge tour buses that go through your neighborhood. Talk about what that looks like to you to see a tour bus going through your the place where you grew up.
Yeah, yeah. Where I grew up is now the Arts District, which is odd. By me having to leave, thinking that I needed to leave to find a certain way of art. But now, because that is an attraction, there's a lot more foot traffic. There's a lot, like you said, there's tour buses that come through. And I'm, just me growing up there, I'm just curious to know, what historical facts that I miss about my neighborhood mm-hmm. coming up that now is being taught to visitors who come that way.
Yeah, or what's being left out. That might be interesting, too.
Exactly, yeah.
Talking to visual artist Cheryl Rowland. Cheryl is the creator of the Jumpsuit Project and the winner of the South Arts 2020 Southern Prize. Just here, we're going to talk with Cheryl about the phone call from a detective in D.C. that turned his life upside down and how he got it back. Talk about that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Cheryl Rowland was an artist in Asheville before the city made a name for itself nationally as an arts and crafts mecca. Encouraged by friends and family, Cheryl considered careers in design and art, but his college years didn't go exactly as planned. Cheryl Rowland is a visual artist and the winner of the 2020 Southern Prize from South Arts and is with me now. We talked a little bit about your life in Asheville. We'll talk about the decision to leave and pursue the arts at UNCG. What were you thinking? Were you planning right away to move into the arts?
No, not initially. Like in undergrad, I had interest in art for sure. I took AP art classes, but I also did a lot of drafting and cabinet making courses also in high school. So I thought my path would have been architecture school, leaving Asheville after high school to go to UNCG for undergrad.
And why did you decide to go to UNCG?
I applied for a few places, for a few universities inside the state. But there was one outside of the state. I can't remember the name. It's been a while, but it was a strictly art school that was in Tampa Bay, Florida. And I remember going through the interview, getting the okay and everything. And I think when I graduated at 17, I wasn't old enough to sign I needed a parental signature for a lot of my things. And moving to Florida away from my mom ended up vetoing that decision at the very last minute and got my hopes up. And then later I decided to just go to UNCG. I have family who lived in Greensboro as well. So my mother was very comfortable with that.
I bet. And maybe in the end it worked out well for you too. But let's talk about UNCG, because you did say you were thinking about architecture. What changed your mind?
Just a lot of the entry courses, but setting up for the transfer. So the decision was, let me just go to UNCG, get the general education courses out of the way, and then hopefully they will transfer over to either NC State or UNC Charlotte, their architecture school. And after reaching out with the department and talking about the curriculum upon entry, I was like, you know what? These art classes aren't really that bad. Mm-hmm. And ultimately I decided to stay with art, just kind of trust my gut instinct when it came to those decisions.
When you did that as well, I mean, you liked the courses, had already been attracted to it as, in high school and even earlier, but were you thinking about what that would mean for a career? I mean, you could take the courses, but then what?
To be... all the way honest, absolutely not. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I had an idea of where I wanted to go, but it was so foreign of a concept to me or at the time of how to reach that goal. The in-between steps to reaching that goal were definitely something that I was very novice of, understanding how to get there.
Well, one in-between step certainly is finishing college, and that turned into a bit of a challenge in your spring semester at UNCG, right?
Yes, indeed. I got I got suspended. I got kicked out my spring semester of my freshman year. And I think at high school, I was able to treat it with a certain level of integrity that kind of I still kind of skated through, that I didn't have to take it that serious. And I didn't really understand. I didn't transition well from high school to undergraduate of like the type of the level of concentration and seriousness that came with that. Like it cost a lot of money to go to college.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that I was wasting money by the attitude that I had in approaching the courses and curriculum when I was there. And I didn't realize the money issue of it, the severity of that, until once I got kicked out and had to go back home to my mom.
And your mom made that all very clear to you when you went home, right?
Yeah, going back again to that no excuses. It was like, you know, I knew my mother, you know, when she was happy that I got out the house. But then it was a different mother when I returned a lot earlier than I was supposed to. It was a completely different mom.
So what did she do? What happened then? You're back home now. Is she going to let you just live there? You then had
No, it was definitely get up off your butt. You got to do something. You got, you know, there was no time for me to kind of sulk or anything. It was, you know, there was definitely a force behind my back. Of getting out, one, getting money, you know, being able to support myself, really getting out there and learning like what it takes and what is waiting for me if I didn't get an education.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it was definitely a different program.
Well, it's one that included work and going to classes at Asheville-Buncombe Technical Community College, right?
Yeah, you know, I had to reestablish trust not only to my family, you know, my mom, all these people who supported me, church. There were so many people that had supported me along the way, like community, you know, like aunts, you know, uncles, like. And that was a big letdown in the sense that I would squander that support. And so going back home, I had to kind of reestablish that trust not only in them, but also in myself. I had to believe I could do it, you know.
So what were you doing? Yeah, you were working and going to class. What were you doing?
Yeah, I had a couple jobs. I had a couple like part-time jobs. That way the schedule for courses at our Asheville-Buncombe Technical Community College, that way it could be worked out. And so, yeah, I had to build up some of these general education courses, demonstrate that I was able to excel at a certain level in order for me to get re-admitted back into the university.
All right, and so talk about that then. You went back probably with a little – we did go back to UNCG, but probably with a little different mindset, eh?
Oh, yeah, and every summer I went back home to work summer jobs in plants and factories. So even if there was the slight, like, wildness or in the sense that I could, like, you know, go back or go back to this type of squandered mentality again. When I went back home for the summers and working in plants, there was nobody my age at these jobs. And I got a lot of talking to, if you will, by people that were my mother's age, you know, like, don't mess up, you know, like, get back out there. This isn't for you. You know, you need this and that. So it was like, again, the community of Asheville, other people's parents are kind of still laying into me about, you know, having foresight and making sure I got that point.
Yeah. So you went back, you finished up. Now, at that point, did you have any better direction, any sense of what you were going to take and where you wanted to go after college?
Not necessarily. I think I got a wide range of abilities while I was in undergrad at UNCG. I knew how to weld. I knew how to code, like ActionScript, animation, things of that nature. But it wasn't one thing in particular that could kind of set me apart. But not to say that it wasn't a bad thing. I mean, not to say that it wasn't, you know, a good thing. It was just now I had to really get out there and figure out what I wanted to do with all of these different, like, skills now.
after college, you went to technical camps. You started working, and you had one job that was interesting, given the fact that we're going to talk about your experience, your personal experience with the penal system in a few minutes. But before that, you had a job working with youth who were transitioning back home after being in a detention center. What was that like for you?
Yeah, it wasn't anything that I necessarily was seeking, but in Asheville, it's very tough sometimes to kind of get work. And so while I was there, there was an opportunity that I had teaching at a technical camp that allowed for me to travel, and teach things like robotics and you know, web skills and building 2D platform gaming, to teenagers. And so when I came back home, these skills ended up translating to where, like, yeah, I've worked with teenagers before and, got into a job where, I supervised a house, for, you know, teenagers who were transitioning either back into the home, or if they didn't pass, you know, or like do well in those circumstances, they would go back to a detention center. So like, you know, in that, in my taste and the experiences that I had, I tried to kind of show more than what they were being shown in their life thus far. Like, you know, there's other spaces that, you know, you could be weird and geek out on some of this, some of these art, you know, interests. Like, you like playing games. Have you ever considered building them? Like, you know, and try to kind of close the distance of some of these things that sometimes seems too far away. And I think that's at any point in anybody's life. You know, some things you may want or see yourself being can often sometimes seem so far away. Like, I'll never be that or whatever. So, I took it upon myself to kind of do the best with what I know, to kind of like bridge that gap, bring them closer to things that they would want to do.
Yeah, but it's a little bit like that experience that you had as a young man, first as a consumer of popular culture, but then putting your own face in the picture. So the idea is, I can be a maker. I don't have to just eat this stuff, which is an interesting thing to try to transmit to someone who may not have seen that on their own. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about your decision, though, to go back to UNCG for your MFA. Why did you decide to get a master's degree?
To teach. With a master's in art, it is a terminal degree. It's the highest level you could get as an artist, an academic side. And so, yeah, in that ability, I was like, well, you know, I'm already doing this in different spaces, kind of like teaching or you know, sharing my experiences. So what would that be like if I was in a classroom doing the same thing, teaching my practice or things that I do as an artist? And so that's what drove me back. And as well as community, being around other artists.
But a week before your graduate program started, you get a call from a detective in Washington, D.C. Tell us about that.
Yes, sir. Yeah. So class started on the Monday. Like today, so it was like last Thursday, that's when the call had came. And it was a surprise to me, as I'm sure you could kind of understand that. One, I didn't have the phone number saved in my, you know, it wasn't a number I recognized. But then two, with what was stated, it kind of threw me for a while, especially like when I told my mom and we had to discuss what was going on. I initially thought the problem was, you know, all on their side. Like, obviously they got a mistake. They made a mistake and they got the wrong person. So it should work itself out on that side. And I should kind of continue.
Well, what did he tell you? What did he say was the issue?
He said I had a warrant out for my arrest, and that I needed to come to D.C. And kind of turn myself in or come see about it. They didn't tell me any details about what this warrant was for, but that he recommended that I come up soon. And I told him that I hadn't been to D.C. in a very long time. And I, again, was like, it sounds like your mistake, not mine. And I know I haven't done anything. But he told me that, you know, if I, you know, stay down here in North Carolina, continue to kind of go through school, if my license had got ran by, you know, police or for anything, I would be apprehended and kind of transported up to D.C. And so I was like, you know, that doesn't sound fun at all. And so I told him I would speak to my mom and try to make some arrangements.
What'd you do?
I went up there. So I had I have a cousin who lives in that area. She was attending Howard, grad school in Howard at the time. And so I spent the night at her house to turn myself in Monday morning, so to speak, and kind of figure out things. So I missed the first day of grad school.
And what happened when you got up there?
A lot, to my surprise. I thought it was just going to be a conversation, but yeah, I really did have to go through the process. I really did have to forfeit all my belongings, get fingerprinted, get interrogated, go to court, and all of that. And that was a full day's process. And there was a lot of details in the in between of how distant or impersonal that experience can be. And by me thinking that I didn't, by me knowing I didn't do anything, I didn't think I had to, I thought I could, the only thing I needed was my truth, right? Like, just tell you the truth. But in today's world, I was completely unaware of the positioning of how those things go, and I definitely needed lawyers and better advisors in the legal side, for that matter. But I was lucky enough to have, you know, a public defender that they got for me that morning to kind of advocate for me and allow me to return back to North Carolina, because they were not going to allow me to leave D.C. when I found out, you know, the level of charges, which were 4 felony charges at the time.
Were you, I mean, did any of those charges sound at all like, could you have been around? Well, what did any of it make sense? Were you connected in any way, or no, I left the night before. What did you make of all this?
Yeah, I mean, I had no idea. You know, it came way out of left field. And at that moment, I was trying to piece it all together myself while going through it, right? So, I remember leaving the courthouse, which is downtown, is by the mall, the mm-hmm. National Mall that's in D.C. But where I had to turn myself in was a precinct that was on the other side of town. So upon leaving the courthouse, I didn't have my wallet. I didn't have a belt. I didn't have my shoestrings. I didn't have any of that. And luckily, my public defender gave me $20 to take a cab to go back to get my stuff. But as soon as I got my phone, I called my mom and called my friends and was just trying to, recall or trying to address the situation, because it was just all a shock, unbelievable, you know? But, yeah, no, it didn't, you know, I know that it didn't seem possible, you know, at all. It seemed completely ludicrous,
And you were able to go back to North Carolina, but you waited 9 months for the trial, right?
Yes. So with the 4 felony charges, they had to produce witnesses or evidence in order to indict me to take me to a trial. And they had a 9-month window to gather all of that information, which essentially was my first year of grad school. So nobody was made aware of this, not even a lot of members of my family, and definitely not the school. And so with that pressure, I know folks kind of go through life sometimes with not addressing things in their home life, and they put on a good face when they go to work. But this was just a whole new level of me, especially when art is so personal and you have to kind of give yourself and your interest to the work. So I was very kind of separated from what I was making, trying to keep a distance that my emotions would not show up in the work, if that makes any sense.
Were you even able to do work? I mean, what kind of art, what were you working on?
I did my best. I did my best. I was mostly just still working on trying to work with other people's narratives. So my history, my mom's history, her generation, how they grew up, things of that nature. That was the work I was working on, and it had nothing to do directly with me. And so a lot of the critiques that came back was where are you? Where are you in this work? Where's your opinion on it? Where's your, what are you trying to say here through you? It's obviously through me. I'm the artist.
Well, what happened?
So there was definitely difficulties.
I bet. Talk about the trial and what happened.
Yeah. So after the 9 months was up, nothing was ever produced. And I kind of figured that because, still standing on my truth, and so I thought the option was for them to drop it completely, because there was nothing that they couldn't take me to trial. So they lowered it from 4 felonies to 4 misdemeanors. And the difference between that was that it went from being the opportunity from it being a jury trial to now having no jury at all. So with 4 misdemeanors, they took me directly to a bench trial, which is just a judge and no jury. And that was scheduled as I entered into my second year of grad school. And that was October 2013.
You ended up spending 10 months in prison, right?
Yes, I was sentenced to a year and 30 days. And so it's in Washington, D.C., and everything is federal. So even though it's misdemeanor charges, it's treated like a felony. So, yeah, I was supposed to be shipped off to D.C. You get shipped off to any federal prison. And it just depends on your time, and it just depends on your charges. But instead, that's why I, wear the orange jumpsuits, because they kept me in the city center jail and their county jail, which is like a hub for a lot of different things. So it doesn't operate like any other city jail.
Well, we're going to talk about those 10 months that you spent in that jail, and then ultimately your exoneration and the projects that you have developed since, when my conversation continues with visual artist Cheryl Rowland, creator of the Jumpsuit Project, the winner of the South Arts 2020 Southern Prize. Our conversation continues after this. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Cheryl Rowland never wanted a job that made him wait until the weekend to pursue his passions, so he made a career in art. But his plans for an MFA were derailed by 10 months in a D.C. jail, locked up for crimes he never committed. When he finally returned to school, he turned again to art to process what happened. Cheryl, let's talk about what you were doing for that time that you spent in the D.C. jail, having been convicted of federal charges. You knew you were innocent, but you're still locked up. How did you hold on to hope?
Praying a lot. Those 10 months and 2 weeks were really tough. The whole experience of the justice system is really slow. So during my trial, once I got convicted, I also applied for an appeal to appeal the case. But because the nature of the case had no witnesses and no evidence, and it was strictly my word against someone else's, there was a slim chance at appeal. And so just like knowing my release date, I only did 10 months and 2 weeks because I got time knocked off for good behavior, and eventually having a job knocked some days off as well. But I didn't know my release date. They would not give me a projected release date until after I had spent 6 to 7 months already there. And then I didn't figure out, to go back to my point about the appeal, I didn't know about any chance at an appeal until about 3 or 4 months in there. And so when that happened, I was made aware that I had no chance at appeal because I couldn't appeal anything. I couldn't challenge anything that was presented there. And so it kind of blew my mind. Like that's ultimately like when hope started being really tough, was that like there was no second chance. This was in a way a definitive of like, I never knew that there was this could be a possibility, right? Like for something to be done wrong, and I had no chance of trying to fight it.
Right, and they completely reworked the system to give you the least possible chance. So we'll drop the felonies, we'll make it a misdemeanor, but it's a federal misdemeanor, so the punishment's going to be the same, but it's going to be a bench trial, no jury. And by the way, the bar for evidence is a lot lower for the prosecution. So we've lowered the bar for evidence. We've maintained the same amount of penalty, and we've given you fewer options to appeal.
Yeah. So, I mean, I wrote out all the time. A lot of communication is restricted and monitored. So writing out was a way that I could really be totally honest about kind of what was going on, even through phone calls. My mother never believed my condition was true that I spoke about. And eventually her and my sister were able to kind of come and visit me. But it wasn't face-to-face. I had no face-to-face. I wasn't allowed any face-to-face visits. So when they came, it was both to my surprise and theirs that they couldn't physically see me. But it was monitored like FaceTime. So they went to another facility and we kind of both Skyped each other from those spaces. And that's when my mom, like she'll admit today, she was like, yeah, that's when I believed I had to lay my eyes on you and make sure that you were doing okay and that you were fine.
What were you doing? We talked a little bit about this, but were you able at all as time went on to relate this to your art or create art out of this?
In the beginning, I wanted to stay in tune with the things that I was learning because hope was still there, right? So thankfully, I had supportive family and friends that would subscribe me to art magazines and things of that nature, articles that I could read. resources inside are very slim to none. So eventually I worked up a friendship with somebody who was getting the Washington Post, and I read their art and style. Nobody read art and style in jail but me, or which was kind of odd, but I was, you know, able to read show exhibitions that were going on in the city or around, and I tried to stay connected in that way, and that was my way of being hopeful. Like, if I get out, I'm not not totally missed anything. But as time went on, and like I said, the appeal notice came in and these other things started to happen, I kind of lost that connection and just started to try to build up what is the next move for me now that the thing that I was holding on to, right, like getting my name back, is starting to like diminish, that light starting, possibility starting to diminish.
Well, I want to jump forward because we want to hear about those next moves and how it did ultimately influence your art. But talk about the exoneration process. It took them 9 months to put you in jail and about 4 years or so to get out of to be exonerated, right?
Yeah. So I got new counsel. It was a week before I got released. I got a firm that came to visit me, and they wanted to take on my case. And they believed me. And I shed a lot of tears in there in jail for sure, in the beginning in the privacy of my cell. But like, that was the first time I got to actually like shed a tear in front of somebody. Like, I got teary eyed. Like, you know, I can't begin in the time that we're given today to begin how meaningful that was to hear somebody on that side, the justice side, that had done me so wrong, or have had the capacity to allow things to go such, you know, to be in such disarray or crazy, to believe and fight for me, you know. And so that was a really big deal. And yeah, the fight persisted for a very long time, but eventually I got my exoneration.
Let's talk about what happened after you returned to school. You did return to school in the fall of 2016. That was 4 years after you initially started the program. And that's when you began the Jumpsuit Project. Talk about that project.
Like, you know, 4 years later, I get exonerated and at the end of 2015. And now everything is fully gone. I'm now back, you know, with my family. I have a daughter now. She was born when I was incarcerated. So like all these things, the world had completely changed. I've been totally, you know, off of art in that academic way for a while, and have kind of like convinced myself that there was a new, you know, while I was on probation, I had convinced myself that there would be a new way. And then, you know, with the charges, and now without the charges, now I have to kind of reassess, like, what do I do with myself now? So, you know, taking trips back to UNCG and informing people, as well as my friends and family, and finally, like, seeing people that I've kind of lost contact with, I started, you know, to try to get back out in the job force and everything like that, and really struggle with just the basics, right? Like the interview process. How do I describe this huge gap in my employment history? Do I, at least on my CV or my resume, say that I started grad school? Because they're going to ask me why I didn't finish, and how do I explain that? And so I felt like the whole time I have been telling the truth, and now I'm put out in this position where I have to lie in order to advance. And that really didn't sit well with me.
So tell us about the Jumpsuit Project, because you went on campus and just walked around in an orange jumpsuit, right? And what was the point of that, and what kind of response did you get?
And going back and you know, my mother encouraged, like, you know, well, if you're having trouble with the job market or whatever, just why don't you try going back to school? And those visits back on campus, I'm looking at campus with new eyes. I'm looking at the art building with a new perspective. And so those concrete walls, those white concrete walls, and solid, you know, concrete floors or whatever, they definitely didn't feel the same. They felt like where I just kind of came from, right? Like, you know, they looked very institutional, very like, just like jail to me. And so that juxtaposition of space really made me consider, like, who am I here? You know, how has it changed? And to really think about and question those changes. And the project itself was a way of disrupting or illustrating that change for me outwardly, very directly. Like, what does a person with my experience look like being out here on this campus? So I took the experience and kind of attach it to that orange jumpsuit in a way.
What did that do for you? Did that help you process the experience at all?
Yes. And it wasn't anything that I had forced, that I had like seen in the beginning. There was a lot of things that I learned within that year of day in, day out wearing that jumpsuit, about myself, about people, about my body, being an African-American male in an orange jumpsuit, about the stigmas attached to that. There was so much that I didn't see in the beginning. But in the beginning, I knew I had to do something just in my emotional state, because I couldn't recognize myself. I had a problem of like understanding who I was after this experience. I had a problem trusting myself or trusting people around me. Because if somebody had the power of doing this, somebody possesses this power, like it's hard for me to get close to anybody. And with these walls that I have built up, I really noticed them within my, you know, being next to my daughter. And so
well, tell me more about that, because your daughter was born while you were incarcerated, right? What role did she play in that relationship play?
Yeah, so like that's when I realized, like, you know, how hardened I had become, not only with the habits that I had built up in jail, but also with this experience in general. And so I had built up a lot of walls for my personal safety. I had become very distant emotionally, and things of that nature. And with my daughter being so young, and then she's the sweetest thing I've ever met in my life, it was a real jolt of like seeing that in my face. Like, you know, she presented that hardness. I mean, like, she made me recognize that hardness every time that I interacted with her, like, you know, what she needed and what I was capable of. You know, that there was something I wanted to give, but was wondering why I couldn't get that far. I couldn't really connect that way. And so putting myself out there in the jumpsuit in a very direct way, interacting with people that I was terrified of, just, you know, because I had trust issues and built up these walls to protect me, really allow for me to open up, talk about this experience, relate to people, other people sharing with me, being able to kind of listen and take on other people's stories, that really provided the therapy and counseling that I needed that was never presented to me from, you know, from the government.
How do you see yourself evolving and your art evolving as you continue your work as an artist?
I guess the same way it came. Like, you know, I didn't want to make work like this in a way, but it came a part of my life, and therefore I just, again, translated it through the work, the experience through different mediums. It just so happened that performance art was the medium that it took. And so now I'm still making it through sculpture. I'm still making it through other two-dimensional objects. I'm still translating these experiences. And even though today is a day further out from when I was incarcerated, the work is starting to be less direct, right? Like the orange jumpsuit is very direct.
Well, and I'm wondering how even that project is different for you now in the, you know, after the death of George Floyd and all that's taken place since you did that project, and how awareness has changed, you know, how even the project looks to you now.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I don't believe these things just started to happen. You know, I think they were already there. I just think the visibility now. So I think the conversations will definitely be a lot more concerning and not as foreign to some spaces and communities that I entered in that orange jumpsuit.
Yeah, I wonder if, even if it changes your approach as an artist, knowing that consciousness has somewhat changed. A few more people are a little more open to the idea than they were when you went away.
Yeah, I mean, it would be great. I still think we got a long ways to go, but I mean, it would be grand if I didn't have to wear it and talk about it. You know, if I could, you know, begin to just be, you know, to just do regular, like kind of like not have to talk about these battles, and it's more aware that way. I'm not feeling so alone when I do bring it up.
You won the Southern Arts Prize for the Southern Prize for Southern Arts. How did that? What effect did that have on you?
Oh, I mean, I'm still trying to get through that in the sense of understanding the scope of that prize. And I think with my like the other artists who were a part of that collective in the exhibition that's presented now, I'm still like looking through their work and just really like taking in a deep breath, like, wow, like my work is being shown next to these other fabulous artists. It's come a long way in a sense of like me being brave enough to be so honest within the work has really connected with a lot of people and put it on this platform. And to win and not only represent for North Carolina was a big deal for me, but also to have these conversations to be so effective, to be garnered as something that's important.
Talking to Cheryl Rowland, who is the creator of the Jumpsuit Project and the winner of Southern Arts 2020 Southern Prize. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Frank.
I want to take a moment to reflect on some sad news that we got over the weekend. Randall Keenan passed away last Friday at the age of 57. Randall was an author and professor of English at UNC Chapel Hill. Much of his work focused on the many experiences of being gay and black in America, particularly the American South. His genius was to render those experiences with subtlety and nuance through vivid detail, full of both humor and depth. In the 1990s, he traveled across North America to capture the breadth of what it meant to be black. He told North Carolina Book Watch host D.G. Martin what he found.
There's a political component, which is probably the broadest unifying sense of identity in which that if you're from Barbados or Canada, politically, when you face a system, you're going to be black. I mean, the system defines you politically in terms of that. And there's a cultural identity, which is much more complicated, but also equally broad, and all those things, the folk ways, the food, the language, all those. And I think we all, that's where skin color becomes less important, because I know a lot of white folk who are culturally pretty black, yeah. And then there's this emotional, philosophical, psychological dimension. I quote Ralph Ellison from one of his essays and says, you know, there's a willed affirmation to being black.
Walking on Water, Black American Lives at the Turn of the 21st Century is one of six books he published. He won several awards, including a Guggenheim Fellowship, Whiting Award, Sherwood Anderson Award, the John Dos Passos Prize, and the Rome Prize from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Randall Keenan was raised in eastern North Carolina and often spoke lovingly of his time growing up there and the influence it had on his work. We will miss him dearly. That's the state of things for today. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hall of Mormon, Kaya Findlay, and Stacia Brown. Sean Rue is our technical director. Al Wadarski helped out today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.